Midhar to a suspected terrorist facility in the Middle East. The agents would have established a link to the suspected facility from their work on the embassy bombings case. This link would have made them very interested in learning more about Midhar. The sad irony is that the agents who found the source were being kept from obtaining the fruits of their own work. Dave, the CIA analyst, knew more about the Kuala Lumpur meeting. He knew that Midhar possessed a U.S. visa, that his visa application indicated that he intended to travel to New York, that Hazmi had traveled to Los Angeles, and that a source had put Midhar in the company of Khalad. No one at the meeting asked him what he knew. He did not volunteer anything. He told investigators that as a CIA analyst, he was not authorized to answer FBI questions regarding CIA information. Jane said she assumed that if Dave knew the answers to questions, he would have volunteered them. The New York agents left the meeting without obtaining information that might have started them looking for Midhar. Midhar had been a weak link in al-Qaeda's operational planning. He left the United States in June 2000, a mistake KSM realized would endanger the entire plan, for to continue with the operation, Midhar would have to travel to the United States again. And unlike other operatives, Midhar was not clean. He had jihadist connections. It was just such connections that had brought him to the attention of U.S. officials. Nevertheless, in this case, KSM's fears were not realized. Midhar received a new U.S. visa 2 days after the CIA-FBI meeting in New York. He flew to New York City on July 4th. No one was looking for him. August 2001. The search for Midhar and Hazmi begins and fails. During the summer of 2001, John, following a good instinct but not as part of any formal assignment, asked Mary, an FBI analyst detailed to the CIA's Bin Laden unit, to review all the Kuala Lumpur materials one more time. She had been at the New York meeting with Jane and Dave, but had not looked into the issues yet herself. John asked her to do the research in her free time. Mary began her work on July 24th. That day, she found the cable reporting that Midhar had a visa to the United States. A week later, she found the cable reporting that Midhar's visa application, what was later discovered to be his first application, listed New York as his destination. On August 21st, she located the March 2000 cable that noted with interest that Hazmi had flown to Los Angeles in January 2000. She immediately grasped the significance of this information. Mary and Jane promptly met with an INS representative at FBI headquarters. On August 22nd, the INS told them that Midhar had entered the United States on January 15, 2000, and again on July 4, 2001. Jane and Mary also learned that there was no record that Hazmi had left the country since January 2000, and they assumed he had left with Midhar in June 2000. They decided that if Midhar was in the United States, he should be found. They divided up the work. Mary asked the Bin Laden unit to draft a cable requesting that Midhar and Hazmi be put on the tip-off watch list. Both Hazmi and Midhar were added to this watch list on August 24th. Jane took responsibility for the search effort inside the United States. As the information indicated that Midhar had last arrived in New York, she began drafting what is known as a lead for the FBI's New York field office. A lead relays information from one part of the FBI to another and requests that a particular action be taken. She called an agent in New York to give him a heads up on the matter, but her draft lead was not sent until August 28th. Her email told the New York agent that she wanted him to get started as soon as possible, but she labeled the lead as routine, a designation that informs the receiving office that it has 30 days to respond. The agent who received the lead forwarded it to his squad supervisor. That same day, the supervisor forwarded the lead to an intelligence agent to open an intelligence case, an agent who thus was behind the wall keeping FBI intelligence information from being shared with criminal prosecutors. He also sent it to the Cole case agents and an agent who had spent significant time in Malaysia searching for another Khalid, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. The suggested goal of the investigation was to locate Midhar, determine his contacts and reasons for being in the United States, and possibly conduct an interview. Before sending the lead, Jane had discussed it with John, the CIA official on detail to the FBI. She had also checked with the acting head of the FBI's Bin Laden unit. The discussion seems to have been limited to whether the search should be classified as an intelligence investigation or as a criminal one. It appears that no one informed higher levels of management in either the FBI or CIA about the case. There is no evidence that the lead or the search for these terrorist suspects was substantively discussed at any level above deputy chief of a section within the counterterrorism division at FBI headquarters. One of the Cole case agents read the lead with interest and contacted Jane to obtain more information. Jane argued, however, that because the agent was designated a criminal FBI agent, not an intelligence FBI agent, the wall kept him from participating in any search for Midhar. In fact, she felt he had to destroy his copy of the lead because it contained NSA information from reports that included caveats ordering that the information not be shared without OIPR's permission. The agent asked Jane to get an opinion from the FBI's National Security Law Unit, NSLU, on whether he could open a criminal case on Midhar. Jane sent an email to the Cole case agent explaining that according to the NSLU, the case could be opened only as an intelligence matter, and that if Midhar was found, only designated intelligence agents could conduct or even be present at any interview. She appears to have misunderstood the complex rules that could apply to this situation. The FBI agent angrily responded, "Whatever has happened to this, someday someone will die, and wall or not, the public will not understand why we were not more effective and throwing every resource we had at certain problems. Let's hope the National Security Law Unit will stand behind their decisions then, especially since the biggest threat to us now, UBL, is getting the most protection." Jane replied she was not making up the rules. She claimed that they were in the relevant manual and ordered by the FISA court, and every office of the FBI is required to follow them, including the FBI NY. It is now clear that everyone involved was confused about the rules governing the sharing and use of information gathered in intelligence channels. Because Midhar was being sought for his possible connection to or knowledge of the Cole bombing, he could be investigated or tracked under the existing Cole criminal case. No new criminal case was needed for the criminal agent to begin searching for Midhar. And as NSA had approved the passage of its information to the criminal agent, he could have conducted a search using all available information. As a result of this confusion, the criminal agents who were knowledgeable about Al-Qaeda and experienced with criminal investigative techniques, including finding suspects and possible criminal charges, were thus excluded from the search. The search was assigned to one FBI agent, and it was his very first counterterrorism lead. Because the lead was routine, he was given 30 days to open an intelligence case and make some unspecified efforts to locate Midhar. He started the process a few days later. He checked local New York databases for criminal record and driver's license information and checked the hotel listed on Midhar's U.S. entry form. Finally, on September 11th, the agent sent a lead to Los Angeles because Midhar had initially arrived in Los Angeles on January 2000. We believe that if more resources had been applied and a significantly different approach taken, Midhar and Hazmi might have been found. They had used their true names in the United States. Still, the investigators would have needed luck as well as skill to find them prior to September 11th, even if such searches had begun as early as August 23rd, when the lead was first drafted. Many FBI witnesses have suggested that even if Midhar had been found, there was nothing the agents could have done except follow him onto the planes. We believe this is incorrect. Both Hazmi and Midhar could have been held for immigration violations or as material witnesses in the Cole bombing case. Investigation or interrogation of them and investigation of their travel and financial activities could have yielded evidence of connections to other participants in the 9/11 plot. The simple fact of their detention could have derailed the plan. In any case, the opportunity did not arise. Phoenix Memo. The Phoenix Memo was investigated thoroughly by the Joint Inquiry and the Department of Justice Inspector General. We will recap it briefly here. In July 2001, an FBI agent in the Phoenix field office sent a memo to FBI headquarters and to two agents on international terrorism squads in the New York field office, advising of the possibility of a coordinated effort by Osama bin Laden to send students to the United States to attend civil aviation schools. The agent based his theory on the inordinate number of individuals of investigative interest attending such schools in Arizona. The agent made four recommendations to FBI headquarters: to compile a list of civil aviation schools, establish liaison with those schools, discuss his theories about bin Laden with the intelligence community, and seek authority to obtain visa information on persons applying to flight schools. His recommendations were not acted on. His memo was forwarded to one field office. Managers of the Osama bin Laden unit and the Radical Fundamentalist unit at FBI headquarters were addressees, but they did not even see the memo until after September 11th. No managers at headquarters saw the memo before September 11th, and the New York field office took no action. As its author told investigators, the Phoenix memo was not an alert about suicide pilots. His worry was more about a Pan Am Flight 103 scenario in which explosives were placed on an aircraft. The memo's references to aviation training were broad, including aeronautical engineering. If the memo had been distributed in a timely fashion and its recommendations acted on promptly, we do not believe it would have uncovered the plot. It might well, however, have sensitized the FBI so that it might have taken the Moussaoui matter more seriously the next month. Zacharias Moussaoui. On August 15, 2001, the Minneapolis FBI field office initiated an intelligence investigation on Zacharias Moussaoui. As mentioned in Chapter 7, he had entered the United States in February 2001 and had begun flight lessons at Airman Flight School in Norman, Oklahoma. He resumed his training at the Pan Am International Flight Academy in Eagan, Minnesota, starting on August 13th. He had none of the usual qualifications for flight training on Pan Am's Boeing 747 flight simulators. He said he did not intend to become a commercial pilot, but wanted the training as an ego-boosting thing. Moussaoui stood out because, with little knowledge of flying, he wanted to learn how to take off and land a Boeing 747. The agent in Minneapolis quickly learned that Moussaoui possessed jihadist beliefs. Moreover, Moussaoui had $32,000 in a bank account but did not provide a plausible explanation for this sum of money. He had traveled to Pakistan but became agitated when asked if he had traveled to nearby countries while in Pakistan. Pakistan was the customary route to the training camps in Afghanistan. He planned to receive martial arts training and intended to purchase a global positioning receiver. The agent also noted that Moussaoui became extremely agitated whenever he was questioned regarding his religious beliefs. The agent concluded that Moussaoui was an Islamic extremist preparing for some future act in furtherance of radical fundamentalist goals. He also believed Moussaoui's plan was related to his flight training. Moussaoui can be seen as an Al-Qaeda mistake and a missed opportunity. An apparently unreliable operative, he had fallen into the hands of the FBI. As discussed in Chapter 7, Moussaoui had been in contact with and received money from Ramzi bin al-Shib. If Moussaoui had been connected to Al-Qaeda, questions should instantly have arisen about a possible Al-Qaeda plot that involved piloting airliners, a possibility that had never been seriously analyzed by the intelligence community. The FBI agent who handled the case in conjunction with the INS representative on the Minneapolis Joint Terrorism Task Force suspected that Moussaoui might be planning to hijack a plane. Minneapolis and FBI headquarters debated whether Moussaoui should be arrested immediately or surveilled to obtain additional information. Because it was not clear whether Moussaoui could be imprisoned, the FBI case agent decided the most important thing was to prevent Moussaoui from obtaining any further training that he could use to carry out a potential attack. As a French national who had overstayed his visa, Moussaoui could be detained immediately. The INS arrested Moussaoui on the immigration violation. A deportation order was signed on August 17, 2001. The agents in Minnesota were concerned that the U.S. Attorney's Office in Minneapolis would find insufficient probable cause of a crime to obtain a criminal warrant to search Moussaoui's laptop computer. Agents at FBI headquarters believed there was insufficient probable cause. Minneapolis, therefore, sought a special warrant under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act to conduct the search. We introduced FISA in Chapter 3. To do so, however, the FBI needed to demonstrate probable cause that Moussaoui was an agent of a foreign power, a demonstration that was not required to obtain a criminal warrant, but was a statutory requirement for a FISA warrant. The case agent did not have sufficient information to connect Moussaoui to a foreign power, so he reached out for help in the United States and overseas. The FBI agent's August 18th message requested assistance from the FBI legal attaché in Paris. Moussaoui had lived in London, so the Minneapolis agent sought assistance from the legal attaché there as well. By August 24th, the Minneapolis agent had also contacted an FBI detailee and a CIA desk officer at the Counterterrorist Center about the case. The FBI legal attaché's office in Paris first contacted the French government on August 16th or 17th, shortly after speaking to the Minneapolis case agent on the telephone. On August 22nd and 27th, the French provided information that made a connection between Moussaoui and a rebel leader in Chechnya, Ibn al-Khattab. This set off a spirited debate between the Minneapolis field office, FBI headquarters, and the CIA as to whether the Chechen rebels and Khattab were sufficiently associated with a terrorist organization to constitute a foreign power for purposes of the FISA statute. FBI headquarters did not believe this was good enough, and its National Security Law Unit declined to submit a FISA application. After receiving the written request for assistance, the legal attaché in London had promptly forwarded it to his counterparts in the British government, hand-delivering the request on August 21st. On August 24th, the CIA also sent a cable to London and Paris regarding subjects involved in suspicious 747 flight training that described Moussaoui as a possible suicide hijacker. On August 28th, the CIA sent a request for information to a different service of the British government. This communication warned that Moussaoui might be expelled to Britain by the end of August. The FBI office in London raised the matter briefly with British officials as an aside after a meeting about a more urgent matter on September 3rd and sent the British service a written update on September 5th. The case was not handled by the British as a priority amid a large number of other terrorist-related inquiries. On September 4th, the FBI sent a teletype to the CIA, the FAA, the Customs Service, the State Department, the INS, and the Secret Service, summarizing the known facts regarding Moussaoui. It did not report the case agent's personal assessment that Moussaoui planned to hijack an airplane. It did contain the FAA's comment that it was not unusual for Middle Easterners to attend flight training schools in the United States. Although the Minneapolis agents wanted to tell the FAA from the beginning about Moussaoui, FBI headquarters instructed Minneapolis that it could not share the more complete report the case agent had prepared for the FAA. The Minneapolis supervisor sent the case agent in person to the local FAA office to fill in what he thought were the gaps in the FBI headquarters teletype. No FAA action seemed to have been taken in response. There was substantial disagreement between Minneapolis agents and FBI headquarters as to what Moussaoui was planning to do. In one conversation between a Minneapolis supervisor and a headquarters agent, the latter complained that Minneapolis's FISA request was couched in a manner intended to get people spun up. The supervisor replied that was precisely his intent. He said he was trying to keep someone from taking a plane and crashing into the World Trade Center. The headquarters agent replied that this was not going to happen, and they did not know if Moussaoui was a terrorist. There is no evidence that either FBI Acting Director Picard or Assistant Director for Counterterrorism Dale Watson was briefed on the Moussaoui case prior to 9/11. Michael Rollins, the FBI Assistant Director heading the Bureau's International Terrorism Operations Section, ITOS, recalled being told about Moussaoui in two passing hallway conversations, but only in the context that he might be receiving telephone calls from Minneapolis complaining about how headquarters was handling the matter. He never received such a call. Although the acting special agent in charge of Minneapolis called the ITOS supervisors to discuss the Moussaoui case on August 27th, he declined to go up the chain of command at FBI headquarters and call Rollins. On August 23rd, DCI Tennant was briefed about the Moussaoui case in a briefing titled, Islamic Extremist Learns to Fly. Tennant was also told that Moussaoui wanted to learn to fly a 747, paid for his training in cash, was interested to learn the doors do not open in flight, and wanted to fly a simulated flight from London to New York. He was told that the FBI had arrested Moussaoui because of a visa overstay and that the CIA was working the case with the FBI. Tennant told us that no connection to Al-Qaeda was apparent to him at the time. Seeing it as an FBI case, he did not discuss the matter with anyone at the White House or the FBI. No connection was made between Moussaoui's presence in the United States and the threat reporting during the summer of 2001. On September 11th, after the attacks, the FBI office in London renewed their appeal for information about Moussaoui. In response to U.S. requests, the British government supplied some basic biographical information about Moosawi. The British government informed us that it also immediately tasked intelligence collection facilities for information about Moosawi. On September 13th, the British government received new sensitive intelligence that Moosawi had attended an al-Qaeda training camp in Afghanistan. It passed this intelligence to the United States on the same day. Had this information been available in late August 2001, the Moosawi case would almost certainly have received intense, high-level attention. The FBI also learned after 9/11 that the Millennium terrorist Rassam, who by 2001 was cooperating with investigators, recognized Moosawi as someone who had been in the Afghan camps. As mentioned above, before 9/11, the FBI agents in Minneapolis had failed to persuade supervisors at headquarters that there was enough evidence to seek a FISA warrant to search Moosawi's computer hard drive and belongings. Either the British information or the Rassam identification would have broken the logjam. A maximum U.S. effort to investigate Moosawi conceivably could have unearthed his connections to Bin al-Shib. Those connections might have brought investigators to the core of the 9/11 plot. The Bin al-Shib connection was recognized shortly after 9/11, though it was not an easy trail to find. Discovering it would have required quick and very substantial cooperation from the German government, which might well have been difficult to obtain. However, publicity about Moosawi's arrest and a possible hijacking threat might have derailed the plot. With time, the search for Midhar and Hazmi and the investigation of Moosawi might also have led to a breakthrough that would have disrupted the plot. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Another late opportunity was presented by a confluence of information regarding Khalid Sheikh Mohammed received by the intelligence community in the summer of 2001. The possible links between KSM, Moosawi, and an individual only later identified as Ramzi Bin al-Shib would remain undiscovered, however. Although we readily equate KSM with al-Qaeda today, this was not the case before 9/11. KSM, who had been indicted in January 1996 for his role in the Manila air plot, was seen primarily as another freelance terrorist associated with Ramzi Youssef. Because the links between KSM and Bin Laden or al-Qaeda were not recognized at the time, responsibility for KSM remained in the small Islamic extremist branch of the Counter-Terrorist Center, not in the Bin Laden unit. Moreover, because KSM had already been indicted, he became targeted for arrest. In 1997, the Counter-Terrorist Center added a renditions branch to help find wanted fugitives. Responsibility for KSM was transferred to this branch, which gave the CIA a man-to-man focus, but was not an analytical unit. When subsequent information came, more critical for analysis than for tracking, no unit had the job of following up on what the information might mean. For example, in September 2000, a source had reported that an individual named Khalid al-Sheikh al-Balushi was a key lieutenant in al-Qaeda. Al-Balushi means from Balochistan, and KSM is from Balochistan. Recognizing the possible significance of this information, the Bin Laden unit sought more information. When no information was forthcoming, the Bin Laden unit dropped the matter. When additional pieces of the puzzle arrived in the spring and summer of 2001, they were not put together. The first piece of the puzzle concerns some intriguing information associated with a person known as Mukhtar that the CIA had begun analyzing in April 2001. The CIA did not know who Mukhtar was at the time, only that he associated with al-Qaeda Lieutenant Abu Zubaydah, and that based on the nature of the information, he was evidently involved in planning possible terrorist activities. The second piece of the puzzle was some alarming information regarding KSM. On June 12, 2001, a CIA report said that Khalid was actively recruiting people to travel outside Afghanistan, including to the United States, where colleagues were reportedly already in the country to meet them to carry out terrorist-related activities for Bin Laden. CIA headquarters presumed from the details of the reporting that this person was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. In July, the same source was shown a series of photographs and identified a photograph of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed as the Khalid he had previously discussed. The final piece of this puzzle arrived at the CIA's Bin Laden unit on August 28th in a cable reporting that KSM's nickname was Mukhtar. No one made the connection to the reports about Mukhtar that had been circulated in the spring. this connection might have underscored concern about the June reporting that KSM was recruiting terrorists to travel, including to the United States. Only after 9/11 would it be discovered that Mukhtar, KSM, had communicated with a phone that was used by bin al-Shib, and that bin al-Shib had used the same phone to communicate with Moussaoui, as discussed in Chapter 7. As in the Moussaoui situation already described, the links to bin al-Shib might not have been an easy trail to find and would have required substantial cooperation from the German government. But time was short and running out. Time runs out. As Tennant told us, the system was blinking red during the summer of 2001. Officials were alerted across the world. Many were doing everything they possibly could to respond to the threats. Yet no one working on these late leads in the summer of 2001 connected the case in his or her inbox to the threat reports agitating senior officials and being briefed to the president. Thus, these individual cases did not become national priorities. As the CIA supervisor John told us, no one looked at the bigger picture. No analytic work foresaw the lightning that could connect the thundercloud to the ground. We see little evidence that the progress of the plot was disturbed by any government action. The U.S. government was unable to capitalize on mistakes made by al-Qaeda. Time ran out. Chapter 9. Heroism and Horror. Section 9.1. Preparedness as of September 11th. Emergency response is a product of preparedness. On the morning of September 11th, 2001, the last best hope for the community of people working in or visiting the World Trade Center rested not with national policymakers, but with private firms and local public servants, especially the first responders, fire, police, emergency medical service, and building safety professionals. Building preparedness. The World Trade Center. The World Trade Center, or WTC complex, was built for the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey. Construction began in 1966, and tenants began to occupy its space in 1970. The Twin Towers came to occupy a unique and symbolic place in the culture of New York City and America. The WTC actually consisted of 7 buildings, including 1 hotel, spread across 16 acres of land. The buildings were connected by an underground mall, the Concourse. The Twin Towers, 1 WTC or the North Tower, and 2 WTC or the South Tower, were the signature structures, containing 10.4 million square feet of office space. Both towers had 110 stories, were about 1,350 feet high, and were square. Each wall measured 208 feet in length. On any given workday, up to 50,000 office workers occupied the towers, and 40,000 people passed through the complex. Each tower contained 3 central stairwells, which ran essentially from top to bottom, and 99 elevators. Generally, elevators originating in the lobby ran to sky lobbies on higher floors, where additional elevators carried passengers to the tops of the buildings. Stairwells A and C ran from the 110th floor to the raised mezzanine level of the lobby. Stairwell B ran from the 107th floor to level B6, 6 floors below ground, and was accessible from the West Street lobby level, which was 1 floor below the mezzanine. All 3 stairwells ran essentially straight up and down, except for 2 deviations in stairwells A and C, where the staircase jutted out toward the perimeter of the building. On the upper and lower boundaries of these deviations were transfer hallways contained within the stairwell proper. Each hallway contained smoke doors to prevent smoke from rising from lower to upper portions of the building. They were kept closed but not locked. Doors leading from tenant space into the stairwells were never kept locked. Re-entry from the stairwells was generally possible on at least every 4th floor. Doors leading to the roof were locked. There was no rooftop evacuation plan. The roofs of both the North Tower and the South Tower were sloped and cluttered surfaces with radiation hazards, making them impractical for helicopter landings and as staging areas for civilians. Although the South Tower roof had a helipad, it did not meet the 1994 Federal Aviation Administration guidelines. The 1993 terrorist bombing of the WTC and the Port Authority's response. Unlike most of America, New York City and specifically the World Trade Center had been the target of terrorist attacks before 9/11. At 12:18 p.m. on February 26, 1993, a 1,500-pound bomb stashed in a rental van was detonated on a parking garage ramp beneath the Twin Towers. The explosion killed 6 people, injured about 1,000 more, and exposed vulnerabilities in the World Trade Center's and the city's emergency preparedness. The towers lost power and communications capability. Generators had to be shut down to ensure safety and elevators stopped. The public address system and emergency lighting systems failed. The unlit stairwells filled with smoke and were so dark as to be impassable. Rescue efforts by the Fire Department of New York, FDNY, were hampered by the inability of its radios to function in buildings as large as the Twin Towers. The 911 emergency call system was overwhelmed. The general evacuation of the tower's occupants via the stairwells took more than 4 hours. Several small groups of people who were physically unable to descend the stairs were evacuated from the roof of the South Tower by New York Police Department, NYPD, helicopters. At least one person was lifted from the North Tower roof by the NYPD in a dangerous helicopter rappel operation 15 hours after the bombing. General knowledge that these air rescues had occurred appears to have left a number of civilians who worked in the Twin Towers with the false impression that helicopter rescues were part of the WTC evacuation plan and that rescue from the roof was a viable, if not favored, option for those who worked on upper floors. Although they were considered after 1993, helicopter evacuations in fact were not incorporated into the WTC fire safety plan. To address the problems encountered during the response to the 1993 bombing, the Port Authority spent an initial $100 million to make physical, structural, and technological improvements to the WTC, as well as to enhance its fire safety plan and reorganize and bolster its fire safety and security staffs. Substantial enhancements were made to power sources and exits. Fluorescent signs and markings were added in and near stairwells. The Port Authority also installed a sophisticated computerized fire alarm system with redundant electronics and control panels, and state-of-the-art fire command stations were placed in the lobby of each tower. To manage fire emergency preparedness and operations, the Port Authority created the dedicated position of Fire Safety Director. The director supervised a team of deputy fire safety directors, one of whom was on duty at the fire command station in the lobby of each tower at all times. He or she would be responsible for communicating with building occupants during an emergency. The Port Authority also sought to prepare civilians better for future emergencies. Deputy fire safety directors conducted fire drills at least twice a year with advance notice to tenants. Fire safety teams were selected from among civilian employees on each floor and consisted of a fire warden, deputy fire warden, and searchers. The standard procedure for fire drills was for fire wardens to lead co-workers in their respective areas to the center of the floor, where they would use the emergency intercom phone to obtain special information on how to proceed. Some civilians have told us that their evacuation on September 11th was greatly aided by changes and training implemented by the Port Authority in response to the 1993 bombing. But during these drills, civilians were not directed into the stairwells or provided with information about their configuration and about the existence of transfer hallways and smoke doors. Neither full nor partial evacuation drills were held. Moreover, participation in drills that were held varied greatly from tenant to tenant. In general, civilians were never told not to evacuate up. The standard fire drill announcement advised participants that in the event of an actual emergency, they would be directed to descend to at least 3 floors below the fire. Most civilians recall simply being taught to await the instructions that would be provided at the time of an emergency. Civilians were not informed that rooftop evacuations were not part of the evacuation plan or that doors to the roof were kept locked. The Port Authority acknowledges that it had no protocol for rescuing people trapped above a fire in the towers. 6 weeks before the September 11th attacks, control of the WTC was transferred by net lease to a private developer, Silverstein Properties. Select Port Authority employees were designated to assist with the transition. Others remained on site but were no longer part of the official chain of command. However, on September 11th, most Port Authority World Trade Department employees, including those not on the designated transition team, reported to their regular stations to provide assistance throughout the morning. Although Silverstein Properties was in charge of the WTC on September 11th, the WTC fire safety plan remained essentially the same. Preparedness of first responders. On 9/11, the principal first responders were from the Fire Department of New York, the New York Police Department, the Port Authority Police Department, PAPD, and the Mayor's Office of Emergency Management, OEM. Port Authority Police Department. On September 11, 2001, the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey Police Department consisted of 1,331 officers, many of whom were trained in fire suppression methods as well as in law enforcement. The PAPD was led by a superintendent. There was a separate PAPD command for each of the Port Authority's 9 facilities, including the World Trade Center. Most Port Authority police commands used ultra-high-frequency radios. Although all the radios were capable of using more than one channel, most PAPD officers used one local channel. The local channels were low wattage and worked only in the immediate vicinity of that command. The PAPD also had an agency-wide channel, but not all commands could access it. As of September 11th, the Port Authority lacked any standard operating procedures to govern how officers from multiple commands would respond to and then be staged and utilized at a major incident at the WTC. In particular, there were no standard operating procedures covering how different commands should communicate via radio during such an incident. The New York Police Department. The 40,000-officer NYPD was headed by a police commissioner whose duties were not primarily operational, but who retained operational authority. Much of the NYPD's operational activities were run by the chief of department. In the event of a major emergency, a leading role would be played by the Special Operations Division. This division included the Aviation Unit, which provided helicopters for surveys and rescues, and the Emergency Service Unit, ESU, which carried out specialized rescue missions. The NYPD had specific and detailed standard operating procedures for the dispatch of officers to an incident, depending on the incident's magnitude. The NYPD precincts were divided into 35 different radio zones, with a central radio dispatcher assigned to each. In addition, there were several radio channels for citywide operations. Officers had portable radios with 20 or more available channels so that the user could respond outside his or her precinct. ESU teams also had these channels, but at an operation would use a separate point-to-point channel, which was not monitored by a dispatcher. The NYPD also supervised the city's 911 emergency call system. Its approximately 1,200 operators, radio dispatchers, and supervisors were civilian employees of the NYPD. They were trained in the rudiments of emergency response. When a 911 call concerned a fire, it was transferred to FDNY dispatch. The Fire Department of New York. The 11,000-member FDNY was headed by a fire commissioner who, unlike the police commissioner, lacked operational authority. Operations were headed by the chief of department, the sole 5-star chief. The FDNY was organized in 9 separate geographic divisions. Each division was further divided into between 4 to 7 battalions. Each battalion contained typically between 3 and 4 engine companies and 2 to 4 ladder companies. In total, the FDNY had 205 engine companies and 133 ladder companies. On-duty ladder companies consisted of a captain or lieutenant and 5 firefighters. On-duty engine companies consisted of a captain or lieutenant and normally 4 firefighters. Ladder companies' primary function was to conduct rescues. Engine companies focused on extinguishing fires. The FDNY's Specialized Operations Command, SOC, contained a limited number of units that were of particular importance in responding to a terrorist attack or other major incident. The department's 5 rescue companies and 7 squad companies performed specialized and highly risky rescue operations. The logistics of fire operations were directed by Fire Dispatch Operations Division, which had a center in each of the 5 boroughs. All 911 calls concerning fire emergencies were transferred to FDNY dispatch. As of September 11th, FDNY companies and chiefs responding to a fire used analog point-to-point radios that had 6 normal operating channels. Typically, the companies would operate on the same tactical channel, which chiefs on the scene would monitor and use to communicate with the firefighters. Chiefs at a fire operation also would use a separate command channel. Because these point-to-point radios had weak signal strength, communications on them could be heard only by other FDNY personnel in the immediate vicinity. In addition, the FDNY had a dispatch frequency for each of the 5 boroughs. These were not point-to-point channels and could be monitored from around the city. The FDNY's radios performed poorly during the 1993 WTC bombing for two reasons. First, the radio signals often did not succeed in penetrating the numerous steel and concrete floors that separated companies attempting to communicate. And second, so many different companies were attempting to use the same point-to-point channel that communications became unintelligible. The Port Authority installed at its own expense a repeater system in 1994 to greatly enhance FDNY radio communications in the difficult high-rise environment of the Twin Towers. The Port Authority recommended leaving the repeater system on at all times. The FDNY requested, however, that the repeater be turned on only when it was actually needed because the channel could cause interference with other FDNY operations in Lower Manhattan. The repeater system was installed at the Port Authority Police Desk in 5 WTC, to be activated by members of the Port Authority Police when the FDNY units responding to the WTC complex so requested. However, in the spring of 2000, the FDNY asked that an activation console for the repeater system be placed instead in the lobby fire safety desk of each of the towers, making FDNY personnel entirely responsible for its activation. The Port Authority complied. Between 1998 and 2000, fewer people died from fires in New York City than in any three-year period since accurate measurements began in 1946. Firefighter deaths, a total of 22 during the 1990s, compared favorably with the most tranquil periods in the department's history. Office of Emergency Management and Interagency Preparedness. In 1996, Mayor Rudolph Giuliani created the Mayor's Office of Emergency Management, which had three basic functions. First, OEM's watch command was to monitor the city's key communications channels, including radio frequencies of FDNY dispatch and the NYPD and other data. A second purpose of the OEM was to improve New York City's response to major incidents, including terrorist attacks, by planning and conducting exercises and drills that would involve multiple city agencies, particularly the NYPD and FDNY. Third, the OEM would play a crucial role in managing the city's overall response to an incident. After OEM's Emergency Operations Center was activated, designated liaisons from relevant agencies, as well as the mayor and his or her senior staff, would respond there. In addition, an OEM field responder would be sent to the scene to ensure that the response was coordinated. The OEM's headquarters was located at 7 WTC. Some questioned locating it both so close to a previous terrorist target and on the 23rd floor of a building difficult to access should elevators become inoperable. There was no backup site. In July 2001, Mayor Giuliani updated a directive titled Direction and Control of Emergencies in the City of New York. Its purpose was to eliminate potential conflict among responding agencies which may have areas of overlapping expertise and responsibility. The directive sought to accomplish this objective by designating, for different types of emergencies, an appropriate agency as incident commander. This incident commander would be responsible for the management of the city's response to the emergency, while the OEM was designated the on-scene interagency coordinator. Nevertheless, the FDNY and NYPD each considered itself operationally autonomous. As of September 11th, they were not prepared to comprehensively coordinate their efforts in responding to a major incident. The OEM had not overcome this problem. Section 9.2, September 11th, 2001. As we turn to the events of September 11th, we are mindful of the unfair perspective afforded by hindsight. Nevertheless, we will try to describe what happened in the following 102 minutes. The 17 minutes from the crash of the hijacked American Airlines Flight 11 into One World Trade Center, the North Tower, at 8:46, until the South Tower was hit. The 56 minutes from the crash of the hijacked United Airlines Flight 175 into Two World Trade Center, the South Tower, at 9:03, until the collapse of the South Tower. And the 29 minutes from the collapse of the South Tower at 9:59, until the collapse of the North Tower at 10:28. From 8:46 until 9:03 a.m. At 8:46:40 a.m., the hijacked American Airlines Flight 11 flew into the upper portion of the North Tower, cutting through floors 93 to 99. Evidence suggests that all three of the building's stairwells became impassable from the 92nd floor up. Hundreds of civilians were killed instantly by the impact. Hundreds more remained alive, but trapped. Civilians, fire safety personnel, and 911 calls, North Tower. A jet fuel fireball erupted upon impact and shot down at least one bank of elevators. The fireball exploded onto numerous lower floors, including the 77th and the 22nd, the West Street lobby level, and the B4 level, four stories below ground. The burning jet fuel immediately created thick black smoke that enveloped the upper floors and roof of the North Tower. The roof of the South Tower was also engulfed in smoke because of prevailing light winds from the northwest. Within minutes, New York City's 911 system was flooded with eyewitness accounts of the event. Most callers correctly identified the target of the attack. Some identified the plane as a commercial airliner. The first response came from private firms and individuals, the people and companies in the building. Everything that would happen to them during the next few minutes would turn on their circumstances and their preparedness, assisted by building personnel on site. Hundreds of civilians trapped on or above the 92nd floor gathered in large and small groups, primarily between the 103rd and 106th floors. A large group was reported on the 92nd floor, technically below the impact, but unable to descend. Civilians were also trapped in elevators. Other civilians below the impact zone, mostly on floors in the 70s and 80s, but also on at least the 47th and 22nd floors, were either trapped or waiting for assistance. It is unclear when the first full building evacuation order was attempted over the public address system. The deputy fire safety director in the lobby, while immediately aware that a major incident had occurred, did not know for approximately 10 minutes that a commercial jet had directly hit the building. Following protocol, he initially gave announcements to those floors that had generated computerized alarms, advising those tenants to descend to points of safety, at least two floors below the smoke or fire, and to wait there for further instructions. The deputy fire safety director has told us that he began instructing a full evacuation within about 10 minutes of the explosion. But the first FDNY chiefs to arrive in the lobby were advised by the Port Authority fire safety director, who had reported to the lobby, although he was no longer the designated fire safety director, that the full building evacuation announcement had been made within 1 minute of the building being hit. Because of damage to building systems caused by the impact of the plane, public address announcements were not heard in many locations. For the same reason, many civilians may have been unable to use the emergency intercom phones as they had been advised to do in fire drills. Many called 911. The 911 system was not equipped to handle the enormous volume of calls it received. Some callers were unable to connect with 911 operators, receiving an all-circuits busy message. Standard operating procedure was for calls relating to fire emergencies to be transferred from 911 operators to FDNY dispatch operators in the appropriate borough, in this case Manhattan. Transfers were often plagued by delays and were in some cases unsuccessful. Many calls were also prematurely disconnected. The 911 operators and FDNY dispatchers had no information about either the location or the magnitude of the impact zone, and were therefore unable to provide information as fundamental as whether callers were above or below the fire. Because the operators were not informed of NYPD Aviation's determination of the impossibility of rooftop rescues from the Twin Towers on that day, they could not knowledgeably answer when callers asked whether to go up or down. In most instances, therefore, the operators and the FDNY dispatchers relied on standard operating procedures for high-rise fires, that civilians should stay low, remain where they are, and wait for emergency personnel to reach them. This advice was given to callers from the North Tower for locations both above and below the impact zone. Fire chiefs told us that the evacuation of tens of thousands of people from skyscrapers can create many new problems, especially for individuals who are disabled or in poor health. Many of the injuries after the 1993 bombing occurred during the evacuation. Although the guidance to stay in place may seem understandable in cases of conventional high-rise fires, FDNY chiefs in the North Tower lobby determined at once that all building occupants should attempt to evacuate immediately. By 8:57, FDNY chiefs had instructed the PAPD and building personnel to evacuate the South Tower as well because of the magnitude of the damage caused by the first plane's impact. These critical decisions were not conveyed to 911 operators or to FDNY dispatchers. departing from protocol, a number of operators told callers that they could break windows, and several operators advised callers to evacuate if they could. Civilians who called the Port Authority police desk located at 5 WTC were advised to leave if they could. Most civilians who were not obstructed from proceeding began evacuating without waiting for instructions over the intercom system. Some remained to wait for help as advised by 911 operators. Others simply continued to work or delayed to collect personal items, but in many cases were urged to leave by others. Some Port Authority civilian employees remained on various upper floors to help civilians who were trapped and to assist in the evacuation. While evacuating, some civilians had trouble reaching the exits because of damage caused by the impact. Some were confused by deviations in the increasingly crowded stairwells and impeded by doors that appeared to be locked but actually were jammed by debris or shifting that resulted from the impact of the plane. Despite these obstacles, the evacuation was relatively calm and orderly. Within 10 minutes of impact, smoke was beginning to rise to the upper floors in debilitating volumes, and isolated fires were reported, although there were some pockets of refuge. Faced with insufferable heat, smoke, and fire, and with no prospect for relief, some jumped or fell from the building. South Tower. Many civilians in the South Tower were initially unaware of what had happened in the other tower. Some believed an incident had occurred in their building. Others were aware that a major explosion had occurred on the upper floors of the North Tower. Many people decided to leave, and some were advised to do so by fire wardens. In addition, Morgan Stanley, which occupied more than 20 floors of the South Tower, evacuated its employees by the decision of company security officials. Consistent with protocol, at 8:49, the deputy fire safety director in the South Tower told his counterpart in the North Tower that he would wait to hear from the boss from the fire department or somebody before ordering an evacuation. At about this time, an announcement over the public address system in the South Tower stated that the incident had occurred in the other building and advised tenants generally that their building was safe and that they should remain on or return to their offices or floors. A statement from the deputy fire safety director informing tenants that the incident had occurred in the other building was consistent with protocol. The expanded advice did not correspond to any existing written protocol and did not reflect any instruction known to have been given to the deputy fire safety director that day. We do not know the reason for the announcement, as both the deputy fire safety director believed to have made it and the director of fire safety for the WTC complex perished in the South Tower's collapse. Clearly, however, the prospect of another plane hitting the second building was beyond the contemplation of anyone giving advice. According to one of the first fire chiefs to arrive, such a scenario was unimaginable, beyond our consciousness. As a result of the announcement, many civilians remained on their floors. Others reversed their evacuation and went back up. Similar advice was given in person by security officials in both the ground floor lobby, where a group of 20 that had descended by the elevators was personally instructed to go back upstairs, and in the upper sky lobby, where many waited for express elevators to take them down. Security officials who gave this advice were not part of the fire safety staff. Several South Tower occupants called the Port Authority police desk in 5 WTC. Some were advised to stand by for further instruction. Others were strongly advised to leave. It is not known whether the order by the FDNY to evacuate the South Tower was received by the Deputy Fire Safety Director making announcements there. However, at approximately 9:02, less than a minute before the building was hit, an instruction over the South Tower's public address system advised civilians generally that they could begin an orderly evacuation if conditions warranted. Like the earlier advice to remain in place, it did not correspond to any pre-written emergency instruction. FDNY initial response. Mobilization. The FDNY response began within 5 seconds of the crash. By 9:00, many senior FDNY leaders, including 7 of the 11 most highly ranked chiefs in the department, as well as the commissioner and many of his deputies and assistants, had begun responding from headquarters in Brooklyn. While en route over the Brooklyn Bridge, the chief of department and the chief of operations had a clear view of the situation on the upper floors of the North Tower. They determined that because of the fire's magnitude and location near the top of the building, their mission would be primarily one of rescue. They called for a fifth alarm, which would bring additional engine and ladder companies, as well as for two more elite rescue units. The chief of department arrived at about 9 o'clock. General FDNY Incident Command was transferred to his location on the West Side Highway. In all, 22 of the 32 senior chiefs and commissioners arrived at the WTC before 10 o'clock. As of 9 o'clock, the units that were dispatched, including senior chiefs responding to headquarters, included approximately 235 firefighters. These units consisted of 21 engine companies, 9 ladder companies, 4 of the department's elite rescue teams, the department's single hazmat team, 2 of the city's elite squad companies, and support staff. In addition, at 8:53, 9 Brooklyn units were staged on the Brooklyn side of the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel to await possible dispatch orders. Operations. A battalion chief and 2 ladder and 2 engine companies arrived at the North Tower at approximately 8:52. As they entered the lobby, they encountered badly burned civilians who had been caught in the path of the fireball. Floor-to-ceiling windows in the northwest corner of the West Street level of the lobby had been blown out. Some large marble tiles had been dislodged from the walls. One entire elevator bank was destroyed by the fireball. Lights were functioning, however, and the air was clear of smoke. As the highest-ranking officer on the scene, the battalion chief initially was the FDNY incident commander. Minutes later, the on-duty division chief for Lower Manhattan arrived and took over. Both chiefs immediately began speaking with the former fire safety director and other building personnel to learn whether building systems were working. They were advised that all 99 elevators in the North Tower appeared to be out, and there were no assurances that sprinklers or standpipes were working on upper floors. Chiefs also spoke with Port Authority police personnel and an OEM representative. After conferring with the chiefs in the lobby, one engine and one ladder company began climbing stairwell C at about 8:57 with the goal of approaching the impact zone as scouting units and reporting back to the chiefs in the lobby. The radio channel they used was Tactical 1. Following FDNY high-rise fire protocols, other units did not begin climbing immediately, as the chiefs worked to formulate a plan before sending them up. Units began mobilizing in the lobby, lining up and awaiting their marching orders. Also, by approximately 8:57, FDNY chiefs had asked both building personnel and a Port Authority police officer to evacuate the South Tower because, in their judgment, the impact of the plane into the North Tower made the entire complex unsafe, not because of concerns about a possible second plane. The FDNY chiefs in the increasingly crowded North Tower lobby were confronting critical choices with little or no information. They had ordered units up the stairs to report back on conditions, but did not know what the impact floors were. They did not know if any stairwells into the impact zone were clear, and they did not know whether water for firefighting would be available on the upper floors. They also did not know what the fire and impact zone looked like from the outside. They did know that the explosion had been large enough to send down a fireball that blew out elevators and windows in the lobby, and that conditions were so dire that some civilians on upper floors were jumping or falling from the building. They also knew from building personnel that some civilians were trapped in elevators and on specific floors. According to Division Chief for Lower Manhattan, Peter Hayden, "We had a very strong sense we would lose firefighters and that we were in deep trouble, but we had estimates of 25,000 to 50,000 civilians, and we had to try to rescue them." The chiefs concluded that this would be a rescue operation, not a firefighting operation. One of the chiefs present explained, "We realized that because of the impact of the plane, that there was some structural damage to the building, and most likely that the fire suppression systems within the building were probably damaged and possibly inoperable. We knew that at the height of the day there were as many as 50,000 people in this building. We had a large volume of fire on the upper floors. Each floor was approximately an acre in size. Several floors of fire would have been beyond the fire extinguishing capability of the forces that we had on hand. So we determined very early on that this was going to be strictly a rescue mission. We were going to vacate the building, get everyone out, and then we were going to get out." The specifics of the mission were harder to determine, as they had almost no information about the situation 80 or more stories above them. They also received advice from senior FDNY chiefs that while the building might eventually suffer a partial collapse on upper floors, such structural failure was not imminent. No one anticipated the possibility of a total collapse. Emergency Medical Services, EMS, personnel were directed to one of four triage areas being set up around the perimeter of the WTC. Some entered the lobby to respond to specific casualty reports. In addition, many ambulance paramedics from private hospitals were rushing to the WTC complex. NYPD initial response. Numerous NYPD officers saw the plane strike the North Tower and immediately reported it to NYPD communications dispatchers. At 8:58, while en route, the NYPD chief of department raised the NYPD's mobilization to level 4, thereby sending to the WTC approximately 22 lieutenants, 100 sergeants, and 800 police officers from all over the city. The chief of department arrived at Church and Vesey at 9 o'clock. At 9:01, the NYPD patrol mobilization point was moved to West and Vesey in order to handle the greater number of patrol officers dispatched in the higher-level mobilization. These officers would be stationed around the perimeter of the complex to direct the evacuation of civilians. Many were diverted on the way to the scene by intervening emergencies related to the attack. At 8:50, the aviation unit of the NYPD dispatched two helicopters to the WTC to report on conditions and assess the feasibility of a rooftop landing or of special rescue operations. En route, the two helicopters communicated with air traffic controllers at the area's three major airports and informed them of the commercial airplane crash at the World Trade Center. The air traffic controllers had been unaware of the incident. At 8:56, an NYPD ESU team asked to be picked up at the Wall Street heliport to initiate rooftop rescues. At 8:58, however, after assessing the North Tower roof, a helicopter pilot advised the ESU team that they could not land on the roof because it is too engulfed in flames and heavy smoke condition. By 9 o'clock, a third NYPD helicopter was responding to the WTC complex. NYPD helicopters and ESU officers remained on the scene throughout the morning, prepared to commence rescue operations on the roof if conditions improved. Both FDNY and NYPD protocols called for FDNY personnel to be placed in NYPD helicopters in the event of an attempted rooftop rescue at a high-rise fire. No FDNY personnel were placed in NYPD helicopters on September 11th. The 911 operators and FDNY dispatchers were not advised that rooftop rescues were not being undertaken. They thus were not able to communicate this fact to callers, some of whom spoke of attempting to climb to the roof. Two on-duty NYPD officers were on the 20th floor of the North Tower at 8:46. They climbed to the 29th floor, urging civilians to evacuate, but did not locate a group of civilians trapped on the 22nd floor. Just before 9 o'clock, an ESU team began to walk from Church and Vesey to the North Tower lobby with the goal of climbing toward and setting up a triage center on the upper floors for the severely injured. A second ESU team would follow them to assist in removing those individuals. Numerous officers responded in order to help injured civilians and to urge those who could walk to vacate the area immediately. Putting themselves in danger of falling debris, several officers entered the plaza and successfully rescued at least one injured non-ambulatory civilian and attempted to rescue others. Also by about 9 o'clock, transit officers began shutting down subway stations in the vicinity of the World Trade Center and evacuating civilians from those stations. Around the city, the NYPD cleared major thoroughfares for emergency vehicles to access the WTC. The NYPD and PAPD coordinated the closing of bridges and tunnels into Manhattan. PAPD initial response. The Port Authority's on-site commanding police officer was standing in the concourse when a fireball erupted out of elevator shafts and exploded onto the mall concourse, causing him to dive for cover. The on-duty sergeant initially instructed the officers in the WTC command to meet at the police desk in 5 WTC. Soon thereafter, he instructed officers arriving from outside commands to meet him at the fire safety desk in the North Tower lobby. A few of these officers from outside commands were given WTC command radios. One Port Authority police officer at the WTC immediately began climbing stairwell C in the North Tower. Other officers began performing rescue and evacuation operations on the ground floors and in the path, Port Authority Trans-Hudson Station, below the WTC complex. Within minutes of impact, Port Authority police officers from the path, bridges, tunnels, and airport commands began responding to the WTC. the PAPD lacked written standard operating procedures for personnel responding from outside commands to the WTC during a major incident. In addition, officers from some PAPD commands lacked interoperable radio frequencies. As a result, there was no comprehensive coordination of PAPD's overall response. At 9 o'clock, the PAPD commanding officer of the WTC ordered an evacuation of all civilians in the World Trade Center complex because of the magnitude of the calamity in the North Tower. This order was given over WTC police radio channel W, which could not be heard by the deputy fire safety director in the South Tower. Also at 9 o'clock, the PAPD superintendent and chief of department arrived separately and made their way to the North Tower. OEM initial response. By 8:48, officials in OEM headquarters on the 23rd floor of 7 WTC